Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Sociology Podcast Channel. And I'm Deidre Ann Tyler, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. John Murillo III, author of the book Impossible Stories on the Space and Time of Black Destructive Creation. Welcome to the show, Dr. John Murillo.
Oh, happy to be here.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself and how your book project got started.
Okay. So, to be honest, this project started kind of as a product of me being a huge nerd. I'm very into science fiction, and there's a particular episode of the show Doctor Who, and the guy that plays the Doctor, David Tennant, at the time, he described time as a big ball of wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff, right? As opposed to like a timeline or some other thing. And I thought that was really compelling to start thinking about how complicated the idea of time and temporality was for Black people. And that became kind of the jumping off point for my piece and my thinking throughout it. And so it started off in like grad school, writing the sort of dissertation version of what this is. And then I kept sticking with the idea and trying to mull it over in my mind and then produce the book that you have here from that project. So it's been a really long engagement with what started out as a question about, you know, what even is Black time? What does it mean to be a Black person in relationship to time, given the structure of the world around us and given, you know, the ways that that world is violent on scales that aren't just, you know, purely material or purely observable in the events that happen in the world, right? But in ways that are actually significantly larger and more perhaps menacing than they seem on the surface. So that's sort of how this all started. And there's also my interest in physics. I've had that interest since I was like 5 or 6. I wanted to be a physicist when I grew up, an astrophysicist. And part of this project was me keeping that desire alive in a new form. So those two things combined with my general research interest in Black studies turned into this book.
Great. Yeah. Can you tell us about your method? Because it was so creative. You looked at the Black creative work and you connected that into what you're trying to explain to us about life and death as being Black. Explain that a little more, please.
Sure, yeah. I wanted to think in terms of, on the one hand, diagnosing a problem. So, you know, what is wrong? What's going on? specifically what's going on with Black temporality, Black time, and also Black space or Black spatiality, like how we relate to time and space in fundamental ways. And, you know, that has abstract sort of questions built into it, but it's also about the real world, right? It's about the things we say to each other in conversation, the jokes we make about, you know, CP time, about not having time, about needing a minute, about, you know, not having space, not belonging into a place, not belonging anywhere, feeling out of place, right? Having nowhere to be. Those kind of casual things that we say that signal much larger or abstract problems. So that was the one hand I wanted to diagnose the problem as we kind of already talk about it and experience it in our everyday lives and in our relationships to these sometimes spectacular events of violence, you know, these spectacular moments of anti-Black violence with the police or with the state in general or with other people who are, you know, authorized by the anti-Black world to do violent things to Black people. They don't necessarily have to be police, right? On the other hand, I wanted to talk about this in terms of what we've made of those or made from those conditions, right? Like, so we have this condition that I'm diagnosing, but then also we have and these set of problems that I'm diagnosing, but we've made things, right? We've made movements, we've made art, we've made literature, which is the focus of the book, right? It's literature. We've made that under these conditions, right? Or with this in, with this as the fact of our existence. And so I'm looking at like how that problem translates into our capacity to create literary spaces and times for each other, but also by extension, how we create political spaces and times for each other, or you know, filmic or musical or whatever spaces and times for one another, in acceptance of or recognition of the problems that we face or that structure our existence. Yeah, so that's kind of the relationship between the creative and the real, or the creative and the sort of the creative and the violent, right? That's why it's destructive creation, right? It's something that is built from the forces, built from and with the forces that destroy us, right? It's with that and from that that we create Toni Morrison's Beloved, or K.C. Lehman's Long Division, or, you know, the movement for Black Lives that, you know, took to the streets for 8 or 9 months this past year. Yeah, so that's sort of what I'm trying to accomplish in the text.
You talked about Michelle Wright. Can you elaborate on how you're connecting this space with her writings?
Yeah. So I had started thinking about this, maybe 2010 or 11. I was starting to sort of formulate my thinking about time and space, but and trying to think about how to use physics in a humanities-based discipline, right? Like in a sociological-based discipline, right? Like, you know, you're talking about something that's social sciences and history and literature and philosophy, and trying to use hard science like physics to help describe what's happening in that field or set of fields, you know, which is difficult. And so I didn't really have a framework for how to do that, or if it would be acceptable as a project. And then Michelle Wright wrote her book, Physics of Blackness. And I think she had a few articles that led up to that book before that. But it wasn't until her book came out that I started looking into her work and seeing that there is a language and a method for thinking about the relationship between, you know, Blackness in a philosophical way, but also Blackness in terms of the physical phenomena that we experience and that we see in and at the base of the world. And so on that level, she sort of gave me an opening to do the project that I wanted to do with a sense of legitimacy because it was a conversation that she was starting to have with us, right? I think we've had this conversation on some level, but we didn't do it in a way that incorporated physics in any kind of serious capacity. And she was like the first person I encountered that was taken seriously in that way. And so there's more people now, you know, a lot of people. There's a recent book called The Disordered Cosmos by Chandra Prescott Weinstein that does this work very explicitly and does it beautifully. There's this book that I just wrote. There's a book called, I forget the name of the book. The point is there's a wealth of work now, but I think it kind of starts with Michelle Wright's work in explicitly talking about physics this way. And that's kind of how I started relating to her work. I disagree with her work. As I do in the book, you know, there's a huge section that kind of tells you why. And it's just kind of grounded in the framing of the idea that she's talking about. She's centering her ideas on the premise that blackness is an identity, and then moving forward with her theory of time from that premise. And for me, that's not enough, right? It's not that she's wrong or that her work isn't useful. It's that it's not capturing the fullness of the problem. And what I'm trying to do is sort of supplement her work by saying it's not just identity. It's about being, like existence, right? It's not just what you identify as, right? Or just what you experience, right? But the fact of existence in the world, right? Independent of what you identify as, independent of identity, independent of desire, right? Which is, you know, also why physics is useful. Physics talks about phenomena that just happen. They don't need to be experienced. The rules of the universe don't need to be agreed upon, right? They don't need to be identified with. They just are. And so I was kind of trying to add that to the mix that she sort of started making. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's so great. In your whole book, you talk about the anti-black world, the time, space, and literature. Can you describe some of the incidents that have recently occurred and how you've given examples of this?
Yeah, it was really important to me to remind myself and the people reading the book, which, you know, may just be academics or maybe people not even in school, that this is not purely abstract and that this is not purely just what we see and experience. And so I really needed to have that part of the book that's really just narrative, right? That just talks about what happened and how those things that actually happened are the sources for these theoretical or abstract claims that I have or that we have in general. You know, so I talked about for the space chapter, for example, I talked about this man Nephi Ottaguin and how he was killed in my hometown of Cerritos. And, you know, he was killed because someone called the police when he and his friend, you know, knocked on a door looking for their friend's house. They were in Cerritos trying to find their way, I guess. And they knocked on the wrong door. And then so they were sort of talking at their car, trying to figure out, I guess, where they're going to go or where the right place is or redirect themselves. The person in the house that they knocked on the door of, they called the police and they said that he didn't look like he belonged here. You know, whatever that means, whatever here is, right? And the register upon which that word here operates is not just like here Cerritos, right? But here in the world, right? Here in space that isn't supposed to be for Black people, whatever that is, right? You know, and if that's everywhere, then, you know, what do we do with the nowhere that we have? So he's killed in a confrontation with the police. You know, he's accosted by them for not being someone that looks like they belong in the neighborhood. And they ask for his ID. And he refuses to give it to them. They allege that he tried to kind of magically, you know, they're at the driver's side window, that he tried to run them over with his car, which doesn't physically make any sense. How could he whip around his car to the side to run them over? But from standing position, you know. And they shot him. You know, they shot him in the heart. He crashed into a light pole. The light pole, the wires from the light pole came down. The fire hydrant next to him had like kind of exploded upward. And so the wires that were live wires were in the water, so paramedics didn't really get to him any useful amount of time, and he died. And it's traceable back to the fact that someone said he didn't look like he belonged here, right? The space wasn't his to have. The space wasn't his to be in. And he's dead, right? And if you have to Google it to find out what happens in the aftermath, but years later they settle with the family, the Cerritos Sheriff's Department. You know, they settle with the family for a couple $1 million or something, and that's supposed to be the end of it. But it's sort of swept under the rug, right? Because the announcement of a settlement suggests that they lied and that they are culpable, and they would have to show that what they were doing was enforcing this belief that Black people don't belong places. So they killed him because he didn't belong places, and for them to settle in public and for that settlement to be made widely known would be to say, yeah, we killed him just because we didn't think he belonged here, you know? And so then I have that same approach to the chapters about time. And it's in similar fashion, right? The Kalief Browder story, right? The documentary that I write about in the book is called Time, the Kalief Browder story, right? And it has these stylizations of, you know, between scenes, they'll have gears turning like of a clock, and then they'll have time on a digital clock running really fast or really slow all of a sudden, or backwards or forward, or skipping. They'll have like a regular clock, and then the hands will move all crazy. And it's trying to very much show that this is a problem with time. You know, the amount of time that Kalief was in jail, in solitary confinement, the amount of time that he lost when he has to spend essentially 3 years back and forth between the trial that never happens because the witness never shows, right? And being brutalized in prison, or being contained in the solitary confinement of prison for, I think, something like 882 days, something close to that number. And so the story is not just that it was wrong for him to be treated the way he was treated, and that this shows the failures of the justice system for Black people, right? But it also shows that, like, there's a problem with how we get to relate to time. He'll never get that time back. or he never could before he took his own life. And the agony of that loss of time is what drove him to do that. You know, and there's other instances of real world narratives, real things that have happened. Tamir Rice was shot in 1.814 seconds, right? Between the time that the police officer enters the frame of the security camera footage and the time that Tamir Rice is dead, right? He didn't, that amount of time was shown on CNN in the little time box on the bottom of the screen that kept playing over and over again. And it was clear that not only was the problem that they shot him at all, right, but that they shot him so fast. 1.8 seconds. You know, that's the amount of time that was given to a black life to confirm that he is not a threat, you know. So time was a problem there. Even recently, you know, with this story that people are debating for some reason, with Makia Bryant, right, the time that was given to her and to the situation to find any other possible resolution was not even considered, right? It was immediately she needs to be taken out, and she's 16. Her sister called the police to help her because two grown people came to attack her, and she was defending herself, right? But no time is given to think about any of that, right? It's get out the car, down, and then shoot. And then the people on the internet, she had a knife, though. You know, she deserved it. You know, or she's not one of the ones we should care about because she looked like she was a threat, right? But if we all took the time to actually think about the story and find out what happened, we realize it's another instance of this refusal to give black people time. And so then what do we do with these things, right? What do we do with the realities of these moments of horrifying violence that show us how we relate to time and space? You know, my concern in the book and in general in my classes and in my own life is just, what are we supposed to do with that? You know?
You brought up trauma work and wake work. Explain to the audience what you see with those two terms, trauma work. How is society dealing with these issues? Because we're seeing it constantly over and over again.
Yeah. Wake work comes from Christina Sharpe's book called In the Wake on Blackness and Being. I think it came out in 2016 or 15. And definitely I would recommend that people go read that to fully grasp what she means by that term. But what I'm saying with the idea of like trauma work is that we're the work that we do, you know, to create things, to whether that's a political movement or some food that we need to cook today to feed our families or something in between, you know, that the work we do is bound up with trauma in a way that we can't escape. And so we always end up having to work with or through the trauma of being a black person in a world that is anti-black. You know, we, on the daily, in big and small ways, have to make effortful decisions, you know, workful decisions, right? About what we do in relationship to the fact of the trauma that is like everywhere around us, that is often significantly far out of our control. And so the question that I was asking about in those chapters about wake work and work and trauma work was, you know, how do we work not in sort of a resignation to the trauma that we experience daily? You know, like, it's not just like, okay, we give up this trauma, let's just deal with it. It's just that it is here, right? And we are going to strain against it, and we're going to push back against it, and we're going to try to protect ourselves in all kinds of ways from the repeat the repetitious kind of traumatization that we get from seeing the video again, or having to watch the trial again, or to hear the news again, or whatever, right? We're going to do those things. But we can only do those things in recognition of the fact that that trauma is real, right? And that the trauma is all-encompassing, and that it is like part of us, even though we don't want it to be part of us, it's just part of us, right? We are by necessity for the world, right? It is necessary for the world to have us traumatized this way. How have we worked through with and against this? Like understanding that it is part of the work. How do we work with and from that, right? As much as we work against it. And so that's kind of what I'm getting at when I say like trauma work.
Now, I thought this was interesting that you brought in gender. And I want you to explain how gender plays such a role in this whole aspect and dynamics of Black life and Black death.
Yeah, so there are certainly scholars whose focus is this that are people I would suggest people read to get a full account of how to answer this question. But I'll point to them here. So I talk about Hortense Spillers in this book because in her kind of all-important essay, Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe, an American grammar book, right? In that essay that she wrote in 1987, she writes what some people misinterpret as this sort of dismissal of gender as it relates to Black people, because it's like, oh, okay, well, she says that losing at least gender in the aftermath of the violence of like anti-Black violence, right? And so it's not that gender doesn't matter, it's just that gender doesn't happen to Black people or for Black people the same way that gender happens for everybody else. So you see this in like the way it manifests in material ways in the world, right? Like the difference in, for example, the treatment by the police of a white woman and a Black woman, right? Gender doesn't figure there the same way that it is figured for a white woman, who is usually presumed to be victim by default, unless proven otherwise. For Black women, it's like you're threat first, unless proven otherwise. Right? And so gender doesn't work for Black women the same way that it works for white women, and that's a consequence of the violence that began with slavery. And so she's not saying that gender doesn't matter, she's saying that it matters, but on a completely different register. Right. So when we talk about gender, we have to like be nuanced about the way we don't we avoid flattening like womanness or even being trans or gender nonconforming. Like they don't even work the same way for Black folk. So a Black trans person experiences a completely different relationship to their gender than anybody else would. That would be trans, right? And so that's kind of the fundamental, like, basic thing about how this problem at the heart of, you know, Black social death and how that, you know, stands in the face of or denies Black social life in some kinds of ways, how that changes our relationship to gender in a really violent and really problematic kind of way that forms of feminism and forms of queer studies and forms of academic thinking and political thinking that aren't Black don't fully account for. You know, so other writers that do this work the one that comes to mind is Patrice Douglas, and she does brilliant work about exactly this question and unpacks that thought from Spillers in multiple essays and multiple like conference presentations that I think help deepen what I'm just saying in a kind of like I'm saying a very basic version of this issue. She has an essay called Black Feminism for the Dead and the Dying. And it centers the story of, I believe it's Corinne Gaines, and the way that gendering for her doesn't function the same way because of her blackness, right? There's Joy James's work. Joy James does a lot of work with what she's calling the captive maternal. You have Zakiya Jackson's work, you know, Sadia Hartman's work with, especially with Wayward Lives recently. There's a wealth of work about basically that principle that gender does not happen for black folk like it does for other people. And, you know, that's extendable to other things, like disability doesn't happen for black folk the same way that disability happens for non-black folk. You know, a class doesn't happen for black folk the same way that it does for non-black people, right? And so it's kind of following that same trend to think about gender that way.
Now, you experienced and you read so much about the different creative works. Out of all of the creative works, which one stands out? Was it Toni Morrison, you know, that stands out in helping us to explain this time and space?
For me, Toni Morrison, not just with Beloved. I know I write about Beloved in the book, but, you know, jazz, jazz especially. Song of Solomon, Paradise. I mean, all her works, I think, for me, are the most impactful in the way you're asking. If I were to pick one person, it would be Toni Morrison. Yeah.
Well, I've taken up a lot of your time right now. I want to know, what's your next project? What are you working on next, Dr. Murillo?
Actually, I'm working on extending what I do in Impossible Stories, you know, which is very like academic and theoretical, even though it has narrative stuff in it. I'm trying to extend that into writing a memoir that is built upon the foundations, the conceptual foundations that I establish in this book. So I'm trying to see what happens if I try to write a memoir that does it accept that, you know, time doesn't work for us the right way and that space doesn't happen for us the same way. You know, what happens to the storytelling process and what happens to the storytelling process about myself when I take those things seriously. So the project is called A Myth of My Own Making, Untimely Dispatches from the Middle of Nowhere. And it's about my life, but it's trying to be kind of a staging ground for putting into practice the abstract things I say in this book. And it's in progress. You know, I'm still looking, you know, for a place that would be a home for it. You know, trying to get a book contract for it. But I'm working on it now, and I'm finding very interesting things as I try to write these essays. The first one I wrote was called Time to Eat, and it's about food, memory, blackness, and care, and conceptually. But it's about my grandma and how she passed when I was 12 from breast cancer. And I found this book that she had been taking notes in, I guess, about 5 or 6 months before she died, on natural healing. And so the notes that she had written in the book, I couldn't look at for like 10 years. And I tried to avoid them as much as I could. But then I sat down one day and I wanted to write this essay that I was trying to get published for her birthday, and you know, try to sit down and do this work dealing with mourning and death, but also care and memory and respect and all those kind of complicated feelings. So that's my next thing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.